Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is with the greatest of pleasure that I say we are joined once again by a friend and colleague of many years, an inspiration, a mentor even, I would argue, Dr. Herbert London. These days, he runs his own institute. It is called the London Center for Policy Research. He has been a denizen of myriad other think tanks over the years and has been a prolific contributor to the public policy debate with more books than I can shake a stick at, but particularly noteworthy, the most recent one, Leading from Behind, the Obama Doctrine and Retreat from International Affairs, really a trenchant and very timely indictment of the previous administration's policies, which I think probably contributed to the election of someone who said he wanted to make a course correction. Dr. London, it is so good to have you with us, sir.
Well, Frank, always a pleasure to be with you.
Let me talk to you about two things that you have recently been musing about, one at Family Security Matters, the other at the Washington Times. The first involves what has been developing and, frankly, continues to be unfolding by the day, it seems, with respect to Saudi Arabia. You entitled the piece, The Saudi Dilemma. Tell us what the dilemma is, as you see it, Herb, and how it is sorting at the moment.
Well, since 1979, when the religious sites in Mecca were attacked, the Saudis have engaged in an extortion payment to the Wahhabi clerics across the globe. This is one of the reasons why you've seen the radicalization of so many of the madrasas on an international scale. What has happened here with the crown prince, he's 32 years old. He's making a bet on the future. It's a demographic bet. 75% of the people in Saudi Arabia are under 30 years old. He is saying, I think they are far more interested in rock and roll than they are in the rigidities of Islam. And as a consequence, I'm going to introduce modernization into Saudi Arabia. Now, needless to say, there's tremendous tension as a consequence. There are people in the large Saudi family who are very much upset. There are Wahhabi clerics who are very much upset. But he has made it clear this is the direction for the future of Saudi Arabia. In 25 years, Saudi Arabia may not have the oil necessary to sustain the present economy. As a result, diversification is probably necessary. Well, that's only going to occur if the economy and the society modernizes.
Let me ask you, there are those who say that this young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who may be king at any day, I guess, acted in part against some of those Saudi royals, and for that matter, some of those Wahhabi clerics, incarcerating them, at least for a time. Some of them went to the Ritz-Carlton to be detained. But he did that because he was facing, not just sort of in an abstract way, pushback, but the prospect of an actual coup against him. Is that your reading, or was this simply the kind of step that was necessary to move forward with this reform agenda? And what do you make of the fact that he apparently released the Ritz-Carlton detainees?
Well, look, I knew he was going to release them. What you have to remember is that Ibn Saud, who was the founder of Saudi Arabia, the first king, had roughly 23, 24 children. And that led to thousands of people in the royal family. You cannot maintain a royal family under those conditions. He recognized that. What he is saying to his relatives is there's only one branch of the family that counts. That's mine. And if you want to engage in investments, whether these are investments in Google or in 20th Century Fox or whatever it happens to be, it's going to be done through the auspices of my operation. And you are going to pay allegiance to me. This is the only way you could get the reforms introduced. I don't like dictatorial methods, but at the same time, I also understand Saudi Arabia is an idiosyncratic nation, very different from other places. As a consequence, if you're going to introduce modernization, there's only one way to do it. Impose it on the society.
It was the communists who coined the phrase that you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, and I guess this is the application of that too, as you say.
Well, as again, I don't buy into the Leninist formulation, but at the same time, it's absurd to think there would be democratic reforms in a place like Saudi Arabia.
Herb, let me ask you about a thesis that was propounded on our program yesterday by Dr. Hillel Frisch of the Bar-Ilan University in Israel, that what is going on here is not just the kind of demographic, you know, course correction and policy, domestic, economic, and so on that flows from it, but that the Crown Prince is actually preparing the country for war, all-out conflict against Iran. Do you think that's a piece of the mix here as well?
Well, when that missile flew into Riyadh, and obviously it was not Houthi, the Houthis do not have the technical capability of making that happen. It was an Iranian missile. That was the claim. I mean, the Crown Prince said this is a declaration of war. He made it perfectly clear. And there's no question, if you look at the putative leader in the Sunni world, it's Saudi Arabia. And if you look at what is happening in the Shia world, it's Iran. There will be a conflict between the two. When that conflict arises, it will be an ugly mess. But there is no doubt that the prince wants to avoid that for the time being. He is prepared to go to war, but not now. And I think that the Iranians have the upper edge when it comes to military capabilities at the moment. That is one of the reasons why the Crown Prince has worked very hard to try and create a Sunni defense condominium that would offset the advantages that Iran has at the moment.
Including pulling in Israel, of course. Herb, let me back the lens up to talk for a moment about the other piece that you wrote recently in the Washington Times about Russia's role in the Middle East, in that cauldron that you've just described. It is clearly playing an outsized role, indeed, and doing so to some extent in supplanting the United States, which speaks to your point about the Obama Doctrine's retreat from international affairs. Give us a flavor of how you see the Russians playing at the moment and whether that's a force for good or ill.
Well, I mean, the Russians have allied themselves with the Iranians and Hezbollah. That cannot be a force for good. What the Russians are doing is, in some sense, nefarious. They've built a very, very sizable fleet in the Antarctic. They've got a rather dramatic air base in Latakia. They have Russians all over Syria, including building four nuclear plants in Syria. They have taken over Crimea. All of this has occurred with the Russians becoming the strong horse in the Eastern Mediterranean. So there is no doubt they've supplanted the United States to some degree. I think the Trump administration also handled this very poorly, and I'll tell you how. When we defeated ISIS, or at least the strongholds in ISIS in Raqqa and in Mosul, the United States at that point did not develop a policy for dealing with the Iranians and the Russians. As a consequence, the Russians have complete control over all aspects of northern Iraq and Syria. When an attack occurred in Kirkuk, you would have thought the United States would have responded. We did not. We have obviously sent a signal to the Russians. You can control this area. This is a very, very dangerous development because it means at some point Israel will have to go to war with Hezbollah. Hezbollah has assembled close to 150,000 missiles in Lebanon. That's an intolerable situation for Israel.
And it, you know, Herb, the further wild card in all of that, of course, as you know so well, is it may not be just be Hezbollah Israel's up against, but it may be Iran, their enabler, their masters, if you will, and perhaps, certainly at a minimum, Russian air defenses that will change very much the character of the kind of qualitative edge that Israel has long relied upon to project power and assure its security in that very, very tricky part of the world. Herb, we are out of time, I'm afraid. And there's so much more to talk about. I'm delighted that you've agreed in principle to come back and spend a full hour with us in the near future, because there's really so much we need to tap your extraordinary corporate memory and intellect to understand better. And I appreciate so much your time today and look forward to doing that before the holidays. In the meantime, God bless you and the great work you do at the London Center for Policy Research, and we'll talk with you very soon. Next up, Noni Darwish joins us. We'll talk about the peculiar situation of the institutionalization of misogyny by people that are not getting blamed for it. Right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.